Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Mike Footer.
I'm Amanda Farrow.
And in each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros. Speaking of lawyers...
Oh, hey, we know some of those.
We do. In fact, we have one with us today.
All right. So our guest today is Brandon Huffman, lawyer and founder of Odin Law & Media. Brandon represents a number of individuals and companies in the game industry. Hi, Brandon.
Hello. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Lockdown.
You're on lockdown? Normally, I'd say that's a weird thing. Why are you on lockdown? Except that right now, we're all on lockdown.
We're all on lockdown.
Yeah.
That's my secret cap. I'm always on lockdown.
That's not okay at all.
So, Brandon has been a friend and colleague for a number of years. He's been a regular source for both of us when we've written legal coverage. And in our introduction week, this is episode 2, because we had episode 0, our 0th episode.
Zeroth.
Yesterday we had episode 1 with Stephanie Tinsley, and today it's episode 2. And, you know, I thought it would be interesting to have Brandon come on to talk about potentially some of the weird legal stuff that's going on as a result of our current situation. But also, we had some really cool questions come in from the community, and we're going to tackle those as well. So I think I wanted to start, Brandon, do you want to talk a little bit about yourself and your experience in the industry before we jump in?
Sure. I'm happy to do that. I don't particularly like talking about myself, but I will. So you mentioned I'm a lawyer. I'm the founder of a law firm called Odin Law & Media in Raleigh, North Carolina. We're in North Carolina, but we represent clients kind of all over the country and some from outside the country around the world, mostly in US-based kind of transactions. But we represent primarily developers, also some publishers, some distributors, and some individuals. In largely any kind of transactional issue or kind of outside general counsel kind of matters where you need some advice, you can call us. And then if we don't know the answer or we aren't well suited to provide the legal services, we can help source an attorney who is and even sometimes negotiate their rates down for you. Yeah, so I'm also general counsel to the International Game Developers Association, and I always have to say when I do public appearances that my opinions are mine, and they are necessarily those of my employer since I am my employer, but they are not those of my clients, including IGDA.
And also I think, because it's important to say this, and I'll say it so you don't have to, that nothing that we talk about today should be considered specific legal advice, that we're talking in generalities.
That's right. Yeah. And also, even if you submitted a listener question and I answer it, that doesn't create an attorney-client relationship between us, and I am not your attorney. If you need legal advice, consult your own attorney.
Or just pay Brandon. So just real quickly, because I know you're licensed to practice in a few different states, can you just, for those people who are listening who may want to engage your services, what states are you licensed to practice in?
I am licensed in North Carolina, Florida, and California.
Cool. Excellent. So I'll dive right in to our first question. And this one comes from a gentleman by the name of, I think it's pronounced Michael Footer.
Wow.
Look, man, I get to write my own questions. It's our podcast.
I mean, wow. Okay.
So I wanted to talk about some of the weird stuff that might pop up as a result of an unprecedented work from home spree across the world. I mean, not just in our industry, but throughout.
I like that you called it a spree.
Yeah.
We're going to have to unpack that later.
It's a spree. Or what I'd like to call my hope for a changing industry.
Oh, very nice.
Oh, yeah. Are there any agency issues that companies or individuals should consider when working from home?
Yeah, can you be more, what do you mean by agency issues?
So, obviously, if you are working at a job and you're coming to an office, you're operating, anything you do while you're in that office, you are an agent of that company. Now, There are some things that might pop up along the way where I'm working from home And I'm also now in an environment that isn't my office. So I might do things I might do at home, but not do with the business. It's that whole thing on Twitter, and just like you said, where my views might, you know, don't represent the views of my employer. But now we're kind of blurring the lines between home and work for so many people. Are there any issues that might pop up around that?
Are you talking about from like a project perspective?
I'm talking about from a project perspective, but also representing your company and a blurring of the lines between where it's very clearly I'm at work, I'm doing this thing, I'm using my work email, you know, anything like that, to I'm mm-hmm. now at home and I'm using some tools that are mine and some tools that are the company's. And, you know, are there any potential legal issues that might pop up around work from home?
Yeah, so there's a lot that comes around work from home, but to drill down just on that, I think you said circle back earlier. Now I've said drill down, and we're going to hit all the conference call cliches.
We're going to do it.
Per my last email.
So to unpack, I think is the one you actually said, to unpack kind of the word agency, right? So agency has a legal meaning that means, you know, authority to act on behalf of someone else. And in a business context, that would be the people who have the authority to bind the company to certain things. I don't think that work from home necessarily blurs those lines that much. The way that agency typically works is you either have authority or you have the appearance of authority, and that is enough to bind the company if the other side doesn't have a reason to expect that you don't have the authority that you appear to have. So if you have the title of CEO, but you don't actually have any authority to sign a contract, the other side wouldn't have any reason to expect that the CEO doesn't have that authority, mm-hmm. right? But when you're working from home, the same company policies that are in place for a company that is of a size that it has policies would still apply, right? The working from home doesn't change the pre-existing policies or the pre-existing authority. It might create a situation where a person doesn't feel like they have to go up the chain or something like that, but it shouldn't realistically actually change anything on the agency side. There are other complications with work from home, though, for yeah. sure.
And we'll want to talk about those. The reason why I brought up the agency thing, and this kind of popped up way back when I was working in another field, where if you are driving your car on behalf of the company to go pick something up, you are acting as an agent of that company, even if you're driving your own vehicle. If I'm wrong on that, just absolutely correct me, as you often do. But
yes.
Does work from home create any other weirdness around those type of yeah. edge case agency things?
Definitely. And that is actually a lot of these things that we're going to talk about vary from state to state, right? So mm-hmm. that's a good example of where it does vary from state to state. But the reality of the example you just gave, the reality there is that even if you weren't working from home, if you were running to the store for your employer in your car, you are working for your employer is liable for your actions, right? So if you hit somebody with your car, your employer could probably get sued. The way that gets actually implemented varies from state to state. There are things like, you know, if you deviate from the path required to go to the store and run that errand, you know, how far can you deviate, or how long can you deviate, or, you know, what constitutes an actual deviation from the path that would remove the liability from the employer. All of those kinds of nuances would come up even if you weren't working from home, even if you were just running an errand for your employer from the office. But apart from, you know, vehicular liability, there's also you know, there's also, like, you think about, like, workers' comp, right? So mm-hmm. if I'm working from home and I hurt myself, you know, is your workers' compensation insurance going to have to cover that as my employer? And the answer there is probably yes, if I injured myself in the scope of performing my work.
So what you're saying is, if I injured myself in the shower, it's not necessarily covered.
I mean, I guess it depends on the job, right?
I somehow don't think that would
I'm recording Foley in the shower, though.
Wow.
Yeah, if you were a sound effect designer and you were in the shower to get a very particular echo or something, maybe it would cover it. I don't know.
But probably not as a journalist, is what you're saying.
Well, but, no, but hold on. Not. But yeah. but that might not be the shower thing. But I think the thing that's going to pop up is, you know, studios, especially AAA studios, where they're very focused on ergonomics and they've got all of the technology and all of the keyboards and mice and all of the setups that are conducive to working long hours in front of a screen with
so we're talking about having blue light canceling glasses or having the blue light canceling monitors, having ergonomic keyboards, having the right chair, because a chair makes all the difference. Mm-hmm. All the things that you and I consider as people that work from home and have been working from home for the last decade, these are the things that we have to think about all the time. But if we are going from a home setup or going from an office setup to a home setup, I can see what you mean, though.
Yep. So that was kind of this whole path that I, this arc, this journey I took us on.
Oh, right? This is such a journey.
So I guess my question is then, if you're sending, especially when you're talking about, hey, I have multiple screens at work, I have an ergonomic keyboard. Oh, my technology to take home, that's my official work technology, is a laptop. And suddenly I'm working on a laptop, I'm working on it flat, I don't have that kind of setup. And now we're talking about 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, who knows of how long
it's indefinite right now, because there's just not enough information about when we're going to be able to when folks are going to be able to get back to the office.
So if people develop back pain because they don't have the right chair but they're required to be in front of their desk, or they've developed carpal tunnel, or they develop, you know, migraines because they're using a monitor that isn't well equipped for, you know, that they shouldn't be staring at for 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, at what point do we then blur the lines and say, all right, this is a workman's comp issue?
I'll tell you, I'm not an expert on ergonomics or any of the medical conditions that might result from things like
so what you're saying is you're a lawyer, not a doctor.
Well that's true, but so I think that right now, the sort of influx of work from home is all sort of perceived to be temporary, right? And I think that most of those sort of conditions, you know, carpal tunnel or eye strain, that sort of thing, are usually things that come up after prolonged exposure. Mm-hmm. And so I think that in the short term, the solution there is to ignore it and hope we go back to work soon. I'm not saying that that's legal advice. I'm saying I think that's the approach most people are taking. And then if it turns out that we are quarantined in our houses for the next 6 months, you know, those companies, certainly companies of a certain size, are going to have to start thinking about those things. Mm-hmm. Your smaller, more indie developers probably aren't even doing that in their offices if they have offices.
True.
Now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So the next question that we have is something that, you know, Mike and I have talked a lot about this over the years that we have been working from home, but what are some employee rights, especially around work-life balance and being new to working from home? What can employees expect in terms of their rights being protected by their employers, or, you know, things like that?
Sure. So the same state laws that state by state would apply to a worker in the office would also apply at home. So just to take a California example, if you're an hourly worker in California, you should still expect to get the same meal and rest breaks that you would if you were working in the office. Just because you're in your house doesn't mean that those things don't apply anymore. So all of that still applies. From the employer perspective, you still have to be careful that you're not trying to overreach on things like employee-to-employee communications, about things like, you know, if employees talk about their pay, you kind of have to allow that because that's potentially unionization activity that's protected under the labor law. So you have to make sure that you're still, you know, following your own obligations as an employer not to overreach on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then the same ADA regulations that would apply if you were, you know, in the office would still apply at home. Now, your employer is not going to have to come and say, put a ramp on your house, right? That's not your employer's job to do that. But if you, for example, if you have, we were talking before about, you know, eye strain issues with the monitors. If you have a workplace accommodation that is specific to a chair or a monitor or something like that, your employer would be expected to still honor that in your house.
Got it.
There's a good chance that you already have something that works for that in your house, right? If you have a condition that requires a certain chair, you probably have that chair at home. But if it's something that you don't have because you're not typically sitting in it for 8 hours at a time, that is something you could ask the employer for. And the same standard of reasonable accommodation applies. They don't have to go out of their way and do something extraordinary, but they would have to provide a reasonable accommodation.
Excellent.
And actually, so that's an interesting thing too. A lot of people don't realize that working from home itself can be a reasonable accommodation under the ADA.
Got it. And I'm curious, obviously what's going on right now doesn't fall under ADA.
But, no.
I don't know of any studio that has prohibited work from home. Most everybody we've seen is encouraging work from home, or mandating work from home. Mm-hmm. Given where we are right now, assuming that in a specific state there isn't an order from the government that businesses must be closed or work from home or whatever the mandate might be, if a business is still open in an office setting and they're not allowing employees to work from home, any thoughts about what action might be able to be taken given everything we know about COVID-19 right now?
Yeah, so I think that it remains to be seen, right? Like, I don't think we've had a situation where we've seen an employer liable for, say, the spread of the flu, right? Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this is more contagious. It's more deadly than the flu. I'm not trying to compare them for that reason.
Sure.
I'm not a politician, right? There's no precedent for liability for an employer for that reason that I'm aware of. There could be. I'm not aware of it. I think it would be a difficult case to make, especially if the employer were doing things like wiping down surfaces or having a mandated distance that you had to be from certain people or different things.
GameStop, sorry?
Yeah, that's the obvious connection here. Like, moving forward is GameStop remaining open and telling employees. Now I want to be very clear about this, that I have seen conflicting reports that GameStop does not have appropriate sanitization stuff. They were reluctant to turn off their demo stations. They finally have. And they have employees who are taping squares on the ground and telling these store managers who make not a lot and these store clerks who make even less to limit the number of people in their stores and, you know, like enforce distancing by you can stand here and you can stand here. Is the company potentially liable, given how many emails we've all received about stores closing for the foreseeable?
Yeah, so I think the standard there, assuming there could be liability for the spread of a disease from one patron of a store to another patron of a store, mm-hmm. or from a patron to an employee, the standard is going to be, was the company negligent in its actions to prevent that, right? And that's a difficult question to answer, right? It sounds like GameStop is taking some precautions, sort of out of the game. You know, there are jobs that just can't be done remotely, right? If you are a shipping and distribution company, mm-hmm. it's pretty hard to do that without having people packing and shipping things.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, that's true. So,
and the same is true for retail, although you are seeing in a lot of places that retail is just shutting down. But
I would argue there is a difference between a supermarket staying open and those people going to work and GameStop.
Because GameStop is especially in this economy, it's luxury. Mm-hmm. Buying video games right now, and this is something we talked about yesterday with Steph.
And it's not the only vehicle to purchase those games, which is part of GameStop's ongoing. You know
what?
5 years ago, don't tell them that. Today, I'm pretty sure they're aware of it.
They should be. Yeah,
their shareholders are aware of it. I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
much.
Reggie's telling them. Don't worry.
I think it sounds like they're doing some things. Whether or not those things rise to the level of, you know, what they should be doing, it is, if somebody gets sick and dies, I imagine that'll be the question for the judge and jury, right? Yeah, that'll be
agreed.
That'll be what gets litigated. But mm-hmm. I don't know that. I don't know that there that premise that you could be liable for that in the first place has ever been tested.
Interesting.
It's fascinating.
It is. And it's like, let's hope that there isn't a need for a case like that.
Well, and I so if you go to like a hospital context, it has been litigated there where, you know, a nurse gets infected from a patient, right? Sure. Is the hospital liable? And the answer there is, did the hospital take the appropriate precautions, right? Was the hospital negligent in workplace safety? And if it wasn't, then there's no liability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
and I think the question is, though, will a judge look at it differently because it's a retailer that's selling entertainment software?
Luxury goods.
Yeah, and so, but that could cut both ways, right? It could be that they have less knowledge and therefore less ability to, you know, protect people from those things, right? You know, is the obligation that a GameStop has probably is not to have an entire hazmat team, right? Where a mm-hmm. hospital probably does have to have some sort of hazmat response plan. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So it could actually cut against liability to say, well, they're just a retailer, right? They don't know how to do this stuff.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, this is just me speaking as a consumer and someone who is whose inbox is filled up with, you know, every retailer that I've ever stepped foot in,
right?
Telling me, you know, sending an email. Like now we're starting to see, because I know that Chapters and Indigo closed throughout Canada, and there's Indigo stores yes. in the U.S. now, so they've closed. Barnes and Noble, I believe, is closing. Mm-hmm. Art of Shaving. I got one from this morning. I bought stuff from them once a couple of years ago. They're closing their
stores.
I've
purchased from them a couple times for you.
Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that it's claiming ignorance in this environment might be a little bit more of a challenge. I don't know. It would be interesting to see how a judge would look at
yeah, that. Yeah, and hopefully no one gets sick and it doesn't come up.
Exactly. Right? Agreed. And that's kind of where we are.
I mean, the other part of it too is, okay, so let's say somebody does get coronavirus, COVID-19, and they do get sick and they do die. How are you going to prove that they contracted it at the GameStop?
And that's the thing, is that yeah. a lot of what we're hearing is that, you know, hospitals have given up. They mm-hmm. like they've given up on trying to trace things back to a single nexus. There's no time.
And there's no value since it's everywhere at this point.
Yeah, there's no at a certain point the numbers just don't make sense to do that.
Right? Agreed.
So those were the big questions on the current situation. We had some really good questions come in.
So real quick before we leave that point, yes. I did want to mention just from an employer perspective that if you're going to be having your workers work remotely temporarily, it's a good idea to put in place some sort of policies around that if you don't already have them in mm-hmm. like a handbook. So specifically things that make sure that you're protecting your property as the employer, you know, if you're giving computers to people, that you're protecting that in a written document mm-hmm. and that you're protecting any confidential or trade secret information beyond just the normal NDA by having, you know, normally your NDAs, if you're in an office, they'll say like, hey, don't take confidential information out of the premises. But mm-hmm. if you're necessarily taking it out of the premises to work on it at home, what precautions do you require your employees to have? You know, I think right now there are probably some developers looking at NDAs they have with third parties, especially things like dev kits. Like, can you send a dev kit home with someone?
Well, especially right now.
Yeah, especially right now where you've got some pretty hardcore NDAs surrounding some platforms that aren't on the market yet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I imagine you have some people looking at those policies.
Pretty now, closely. You're talking about the Switch Pro, correct? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, this
my Animal Switch Crossing Pro. Switch is going to be here, right? Yeah. Like, that's what we're talking about.
No, that one's on the market. Everybody
else has theirs. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I just get mine late.
Yeah.
Oh.
You'll get yours early. You'll get it before the game comes out.
Stop being like this.
I have to decide if I want to go to my office to pick up my Doom Collector's Edition from the hallway where it's going to be delivered this week.
Okay, if you do that, I expect a picture with you wearing the helmet.
It's true. This is required.
Yeah. I like how it's not a cat helmet like the Halo 3 one was. Like, it's an actual helmet that you can wear mm-hmm. as a human being. I mean, I probably couldn't because my head is giant. But
well, yeah, they say it is, but I imagine, I don't know. We'll
see. I've seen people wearing it. I've seen people receive them early wearing it, so it is... For it's some humans, wearable. All right.
So I have to decide if it's worth braving coronavirus to go pick up my Doom helmet.
You know the answer is yes.
Protect me from the coronavirus. It'll keep me from touching my face, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
I don't know if you'll be able to see out of it while you're playing, but good luck.
Oh my goodness.
This game's amazing. I can't see it, but I love the helmet.
It's real good. It's real good.
All right. So moving off of our current situation, looking ahead to when...
And Doom helmets.
To when people are able to start being around one another again. Our first question comes from Matthew Glenn. This one was sent via Twitter. And Matthew had been reading up about the Glory Society and Motion Twin and their approach to co-ops. And he asks, he says, my team of four are interested in organizing our new game dev business as a co-op. Do you have any tips for where to start?
Sure. So co-ops, for anybody listening that isn't aware of what a co-op is sort of an alternative structure for a company. I'm assuming he means like an employer-owned co-op. Mm-hmm. But basically, it's the workers own the company, mm-hmm. and it's a sort of democratic system. How that gets implemented specifically, again, unfortunately, varies from state to state. So it's hard to say specifically, these are the steps you would take, right? So I would say as a starting point, look at the state that those people are in or the state where that co-op is going to be based. If it's going to be, you know, everybody remote and distributed, it's got to be organized somewhere in order to have legal authority. So look at the state laws in that place. There are resources specific to co-ops that sort of walk through like what to think about around, you know, organizational development and governance and how do you want those things to work. And then beyond that, thinking through how you're going to fund this, because even though it's a co-op, there still has to be money involved, right? You still have to pay for licenses and things like that to develop a game. So thinking of, you know, because it's democratic, because it's employee owned, does everybody have to contribute equally to the expenses? And if not, how do you deal with that? So it's some of the same issues as a normal company, mm-hmm. But the governance and the ownership is the difference, right? It is owned by the employees, and it is there can be an elected board, but every employee would get typically one vote to that to decide who gets to be on that elected board. But the difficulty, honestly, with a co-op is disagreements are hard to deal with. That's true anytime you have a large number of shareholders. And if your team of four ends up turning into a team of 40, it ends up getting pretty difficult to get consensus around an issue with that many people. So that's one difficulty. Another is if it's an employee-owned company, it's a co-op, it has to remain an employee-owned company. Unless everybody agrees not to be anymore, right? And the threshold for everybody, it could be a majority, but unless there's an agreement not to be anymore. So let's say you form this co-op and then down the line, you get a potential offer of investment from a publisher that is, in addition to the publishing deal, they want to give you some equity. They want to buy some equity in your company. Well, you can't do that in a co-op, right? Because the publisher is not an employee.
Right.
So they can't be an owner. So you are limiting yourself in some ways by being a more democratic organization. And then the last thing I would say is find a lawyer who's done that before, who's done co-op work before. I'll be honest, I haven't. I would refer that out because it's not a traditional company organization. It's not something that I've done over and over and over again. I would find somebody else to work on that. I probably wouldn't even work on it.
And is that... an official is co-op an official designation at the state level, like LLC or C corp or S corp?
So in some states it is, and in other states, a co-op could be an LLC or a corporation that functions as a co-op through its governing documents. Okay. In most states, you can't use the word like cooperative in the name of your company unless you go through some other procedural hurdle to show that you are in fact a cooperative. You can't use the word bank in your company name. Like I couldn't create a game developer called like, you know, Games Bank.
I'm sorry, that did you say work. Game Spank? Could you call your company Game Spank?
You
even
could
though
call
it sounds
bank,
like Games Bank?
Believe it or not, I think you could. I don't think anybody would. I don't know that it's a great name, but nobody would stop you at the state level.
It's pretty memorable, though. You got to give it that.
Yeah, I think that might be better as like maybe a podcast.
Well, that's the next. That's our next podcast.
Please subscribe to our OnlyFans, I guess.
Wow. I want no part of the rest of that. That's the no thank you, hard pass. Okay, so we have another question. This is another question that came in through Twitter from Steve Augustine. I was looking to hear a discussion about the rise of user-generated content-focused platforms like Dreams, and who owns that content between the creator or the aggregator? Who I don't really understand. Like,
the aggregator would be Sony and Media Molecule, who made the platform and who pull that content together. So it's the set of tools.
Aggregation.
It's not really aggregation. But like, I know what he's getting at.
Okay, so I think that what the actual question aside, I think that what Steve's getting at here is, you know, we see a lot of blurring of the lines between, you know, platforms that have their own content, and you can build things in places like Steam Workshop and everything like that, and that's all fine and dandy. It has its own little silo. But for something like Dreams, where the content can only be built because of the platform that's been created by another company that's run on a proprietary system and everything like that. Like, how does that even work? Like, who owns that content?
And just to kind of lump this in with it, I feel like this is kind of at least partially related to the modding conversation.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
You know,
before
Dreams, it was Little Big Planet. Mm-hmm. You know,
oh, I love
or Mario Maker 2. You know, or Mario Maker 2. But, you know, Dreams is, I would say, so much more fully featured than anything that's come before it, that it was an interesting one that got called out.
Yeah. So it's not that different, though, in legal terms from the other stuff, right? It's not, from a legal perspective, it's not that different from, you know, Rust, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that different from, you mentioned Mario Maker. It's not that different from even really Facebook or YouTube, right? The content you make is yours if you make it outside the platform. If you make it inside the platform, then it's yours when you create it, but subject to the terms of the agreement you agreed to when you jumped into the platform, right?
Okay.
So with something like Facebook or YouTube, you still own the content you post, assuming you owned it to begin with, but you own the stuff you post, you give Facebook a license to do certain things. I haven't looked specifically at the terms for Dreams.
Nobody who's used Dreams has read the EULA.
I haven't even started Dreams yet, so I'll have to read the EULA.
So I would assume that the same sort of framework is there, that you own what you create, but you give Sony a pretty expansive license to use it, both because they need that license in order to actually deliver the platform. If you're sharing your dream space with someone else, they have to have, Sony has to be able to copy it in order to show it to those other people. Mm-hmm. But also because they want to be able to use, you know, really good content and things like marketing Dreams, right? So there's probably a pretty expansive license. I haven't looked at that, so I don't know that for sure. But the flip side of that is they probably don't actually want to be considered the owner of the stuff that gets posted there.
That's true, because people could do some really bad stuff.
Well, they already are. I mean, there's ton of copyright infringement in there, a ton of it. And so in order to save themselves from liability for that sort of stuff, they have to be sort of agnostic to the content. And to be agnostic, you really don't want to be the owner of it, right? The quote unquote owner. You could take a bunch of licensed rights, but if you're the owner, then theoretically you're more liable for it, right? But under the DMCA and the Communications Decency Act, like, your exemptions from liability as a platform holder kind of depend on your ability to say to whoever put it up, you need to take this down. This is yours, not mine. Take it down, right? Or you know, just take it down for them. But which is more realistic than just taking it down for them. But being able to say, like, we're taking this down because you did this thing that you are responsible for, not us.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So we have one more question. And this is a biggie. And I hope you're ready. I know you're ready because I sent it to you in advance. We cheated a little bit so that Brandon was prepared. It's not cheating. We're just giving you better content. So this one comes.
You can edit that out. You don't have to tell people that we cheated.
I know.
It's not cheating.
It's not cheating.
It's
preparing your guest who is giving you technical legal information so that they're not blindsided.
This is important.
This is responsible podcasting. Gosh. So this one comes from a listener. I don't know their real name, but on Twitter they are at Shadow Hacksaw. Regarding the recent NVIDIA GeForce controversy, is NVIDIA actually breaking end-user license agreement? And if so, why haven't these publishers gone after other companies such as Shadow? Shadow runs a service called Blade, right? Or is it Blade Shadow?
So Blade is the company. Shadow is the service.
Which gives you a virtual Windows 10 PC, and you can do anything you want with it. And I've talked about this a little bit on Twitter, and you may tell me that everything I thought was wrong. But Shadow Hacksaw says he'd love to understand the legal side of this. Now, just to give some quick underpinning of what's going on, GeForce launched. It launched at a great price point. I think it was like, what, $12 a month?
I think so.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. It was very affordable.
Yes.
And they had this amazing library of games. Now, some of those games were equipped with cloud saves. And it links to your Steam profile and I think maybe some other storefront profiles. And then says, okay, you own this game. Well, we're going to let you stream it from our servers. Then you had a number of companies, Bethesda, 2K, Activision, who said, excuse me? We didn't give you permission to do this. And then they pulled...
their library.
They pulled the libraries from GeForce. So, Shadow Hacksaw wants to know, Brandon, what's up?
Yeah. So, my assumption here is that NVIDIA doesn't want to have the fight with those bigger companies, right? That you get into sort of some nuanced areas of copyright law here. So, the way that copyright works is when you are the creator of something, when you are the owner of the copyright in something, you have certain exclusive rights. One of those rights is the right to make copies, right? That's the easiest one to sort of understand, the right to make copies. Based on what I've seen about the NVIDIA platform, that I think requires them to actually make a copy of the game that lives in their server, right?
That was my understanding, that they are then distributing it from their servers.
Right. And the right to distribute is another copyright protected right. So I think that the way that they are actually executing it is part of the difficulty, that your purchase on Steam entitles you to a licensed copy through Steam. It does not necessarily entitle NVIDIA to make a copy separate and apart from your licensed version in order to deliver this service. Now, I don't know that the technical side of that is entirely accurate, but my guess is that NVIDIA's legal department has looked at that situation and said, you know, there's some risk here. Do we want to have the fight or do we just want to take it down?
Right. I think that that's the big difference between how something like a virtual machine or a virtual PC, like what Blade Shadow is offering versus GeForce now, because it is a different kind of service and they aren't actually giving you a virtual machine.
Yeah, and I have this,
I mean, they kind of are, but it's not to the same granularity that you get it with Shadow. Shadow, it is literally your PC, but in the cloud. That is how that works.
So, but to give you kind of an insight into how nuanced this gets, so are you familiar with Aereo? Does that name mean anything to you?
No, not for me, anyway.
So Aereo was a company, and that's an important part of this.
RIP Aereo.
Yeah, Aereo, they might still exist, but I think that they are gone for good now at this point. But they were a company that basically allowed you to, it wasn't games, it was TV, basically allowed you to rent an antenna.
Yes, so I do remember this.
You could get over-the-air content delivered through the internet.
But from anywhere.
From anywhere. You would rent an antenna. I think it was in New York City or something like that. But you would rent a physical antenna. It was your antenna. You didn't share the antenna with anybody else. Or at least they said you didn't. I don't know if that's accurate or not. But you didn't share that antenna. It was your antenna, just like it would be your PC. It was your copy, right? It was your antenna. And then the content that antenna received, you could then stream to your PC or your phone or anywhere else to watch it.
Yep, but you didn't have to be local, which is a key piece of the over-the-air.
Right, exactly. So basically, under the copyright law, one of your other rights as a copyright holder is the right to transmit, which is a very specifically defined word that really is there to protect the broadcast networks from cable companies doing exactly what Aereo was doing, but over cable networks, right? So that got litigated, and that got litigated to the point that it was an argument in front of the United States Supreme Court that Aereo ended up losing.
Hence RIP Aereo.
Right, hence RIP Aereo. So my assumption with both Shadow and NVIDIA is that both of them are probably existing in a little bit of gray area, right? That they are doing this to either, you know, establish precedent, or because they think that the market will side with them and they'll be okay. And, you know, if there is a fight, they'll be able to win it long term, because in gray, you can always push it black or white a little bit, right? But the answer to that is that it's complicated, right?
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think the transmission right would come up here, because it's specific. It's very specifically defined under the Copyright Act. But it just is a good example of how complicated those issues can get.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We're so excited that Brandon was able to join us. Brandon, before you go, why don't you let people know where they can find you online?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Brandon J. Huffman, and I'm on just the regular old internet at odinlaw.com.
Thank you so much, and we will talk to you soon. So grateful to have you on and have you share your wisdom with us and our audience.
Yeah, thank you. And so I've listened to every episode so far, and it's been great.
Thank you so much.
That makes me really happy.
I appreciate that. We appreciate that.
We had a good time. Absolutely. Yes. So thanks for coming on. And
we will definitely have you back.
Yes. For more legalese. But maybe while you're wearing your Doom helmet.
Yes. You have to speak to us through the Doom helmet.
We can do it by Skype, so you get video.
Yes. I mean, we can technically do that on Discord, too. But that is great. I guess
that's true. It's true. All right, Brandon, thank you so much.
Our indie spotlight today is Unbound Creations and founder Jakub Kosztalski talking about their new game. Jakub, tell us a little bit about your game.
Our game is titled Rain on Your Parade. It's a slapstick comedy game where you play as a mischievous cloud and rain on everyone's parade. It has numerous levels with unique objectives that'll test your skills and deduction, each getting progressively more ridiculous. And you can unlock new abilities and discover new mechanics going far beyond just raining on people. And then, of course, you can go back and replay older levels to find new secrets and improve your score. If you're a fan of Untitled Goose Game, Donut County, or Goat Simulator, this will be definitely right up your alley.
Jakub, I absolutely love the look of this game, in no small part due to the fact that you're using the same asset pack that was used in my first book, The Game Dev Business Handbook. Question, were you planning on going to GDC or E3, and if so, how have those cancellations affected you?
Yes, and not just GDC and E3. This month alone, we are planning to attend or exhibit at three different conferences, all of which have been cancelled. There's several international ones later in the year I am also uncertain of attending anymore. As for GDC, I was actually a speaker this year, discussing our previous game titled Headliner, and how we designed it to make players question fake news and media manipulation. My talk will be available online as a video, but it's still a bummer I will not be able to give it in person. And with E3, we were planning to exhibit Rain on Your Parade as part of Indiecade. I was really counting on these events to connect with our audience, influencers, as well as gaming press. We're at the stage where marketing is very important, so not being able to easily put the game in front of the right people definitely puts a dent in our plans. We have to rethink our strategy and focus more on online efforts.
I'm glad we're going to get a chance to see your talk, even if it isn't quite how you originally envisioned. So how far along are you in development, and what are the things that you need right now in order to get to that next phase?
We're about 4 months into development, with a very solid beta and all major mechanics implemented. Our focus now is just adding content, polishing the art style, and smoothing out gameplay experience. We have a good idea where we want to go with this game, and it's just a matter of getting it done at this point. As for our needs, marketing is always a big challenge. So we're constantly looking for streamers and YouTubers interested in playing it, or news sites to write about it. We're also currently hiring an extra developer and a PR person. I had a few meetings scheduled at GDC, which I am now conducting online. Lastly, we're definitely interested in exploring new platforms like Apple Arcade or Epic Store as a possibility.
Well, it sounds great. I'm really excited to hear more about the game as it continues on, especially with that great art style. So tell me, is there a place where people can find you online? Do you have a Steam page or an itch.io page where people can wishlist the game?
Yes, our studio Twitter is at Unbound Creation. That's UnboundCreation. It's the name of our studio with no spaces and no S at the end due to the Twitter character limits. And yes, you can find our game on Steam as well. Just search for Rain on Your Parade. Thanks.
Thank you, Jakob. This is great. I can't wait to find out more about Rain on Your Parade. And if you are an indie developer and you would like to be part of our indie spotlight, you can email us at podcast@fsquared.biz, or you can send us a DM at our Twitter, which is @virtualeconcast. Our DMs are open.
Yes, they are. I'm really glad that we have that ability right now. Might have to close DMs at some point.
Maybe. We'll see. We can just filter out the people calling me names.
Why would anybody call you names?
Oh, there are so many reasons.
Wow. Okay. Well... I'm not calling you names, but we do have some cool guests this week. We have Matt Piscatella tomorrow, and Matt is a video game industry analyst at NPD, and we've been saying all week how smart Matt is, but we're going to say it one more time. Matt's really, 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 really smart.
I hope he's listening to this so that he knows the shoes that he must fill.
He will.
The expectations
of him being smart, yes, and entertaining.
Yes.
Yes, he can do both, yes, of these things, though. He's very capable. And then on Friday, we have the wonderful Victoria Tran, who is the communications director at Kit Fox Games. They are making Boyfriend Dungeon.
Yes. And among other things.
There are a number of different games that Kit Fox is both making and publishing.
But I would like to date my sword.
I'm so excited for Boyfriend Dungeon. I just need it now. I wish I could have that game now.
I demoed it at PAX West. PAX
I think you East? Did. I think it was last year. It was last year. I think it was PAX West because I couldn't go to that. I couldn't go to that appointment.
It might have been. No, I think it was PAX East.
Was
I think
it PAX,
it was PAX
East?
East 2019?
Oh, so jealous. I haven't even played that game
so
yet.
So good.
Oh man. Need it. Need it in my life. Okay, so we have wonderful guests lined up for the rest of the week, and that's it. I mean. That's episode three.
Episode two, because it's the zeroth episode.
That's right. So it's technically our third episode, but it is episode two. That's going to mess me up.
It's going to mess us up when we get to episode 100. Wait, this is actually the 101st episode. We missed our anniversary.
Oh, no.
So thank you very much again to Brandon Huffman from Odin Law and Media for joining us today. We're so grateful for his wisdom and for taking some time to be on the show during our inaugural week.
I learned a lot.
I always learn a lot when I talk to Brandon.
I learned a lot about American law, things that I didn't realize.
American
law. So thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy podcast. I can't believe that this is just week one.
Yeah.
I feel like it's been a month since we launched.
Well, 2020 has been a decade long already.
It really has been. We're only in March. You can follow us on Twitter as @VirtualEconCast. I am @AmandaFarrow, and
I am @Footerish, FUTTERISH.
So he's the ishy footer.
I'm ishy. There's a long story behind that, but that's another show.
That is for not this show.
Yeah. You can also subscribe to our RSS feed, so you can get Virtual Economy dumped right into your RSS at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Stitcher. We are on the Google Play Podcasts, and we're on Spotify now.
We are on Spotify, really cool.
We're just waiting for Apple.
We are just waiting for Apple to give us the thumbs up, hopefully. Everything is very high quality, so I'm still waiting on an email. I'm assuming that it's going to take about a week for them to get back to us.
Sure.
So...
And if there is a platform that you do prefer to listen to your podcasts on that we are not on yet,
definitely
let us know.
Yeah, get at us on Twitter. Let us know where you'd like to see us. Chances are that we've either A, forgotten about it, or B, we just don't know about it because we are brand new to publishing on a multitude of platforms. Even though I have been doing this whole podcasting thing for a long time, I've mostly just focused on the major ones. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So...
If you have questions that you have, if you want to ask us questions, our DMs are always open. You can also email podcast@fsquared.biz. If you have questions specifically for Matt Piscatella, who will be our guest tomorrow, as Manda mentioned, or Victoria Tran, who was our guest on Friday, please let us know that also. If you want us to ask a very specific person, we'll bring them up during the show. We had great questions today.
Oh, wonderful. Loved questions.
That. And we will be back soon. In the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be